from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, UC Berkeley economist Enrico Moretti joins us to discuss his research on what he calls the Great Divergence in the United States, which boils down to the idea that the geographical divide between communities may be more important economically than race or class. His book is called The New Geography of Jobs. He'll join us for the hour in studio. That's up ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Joining us in the studio this hour of Forum is Professor of Economics at UC Berkeley, Enrico Moretti, who is the author of a new book called The New Geography of Jobs. Well, where you live may matter more than you think, and that's really one of the major theses of the book, along with the importance of innovation at all levels. The key to innovation really in terms of the economy appears to be disproportionate and much greater than maybe many of us thought. A new geography of jobs really tells us that the benefits to the centers of innovation, San Francisco, Boston, Austin, cities like that, are great and continue to be great, and that there's a real gap between not so much red and blue states, but maybe communities that have innovation and communities that have educated people and those that don't. And welcome to the program.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Did I state that pretty precisely in terms of your
yes.
your main argument here? It's an argument that says, to a great extent, it matters more than we think where we live. And it affects not only our lives, of course, but the lives of everybody. It brings up the wages even of not necessarily the people who are making a lot of money.
It does. If you look at the economic map of America today, you don't see just one country. You see three increasingly different countries. On one end, you have cities like San Francisco or Seattle, Austin, Raleigh, Durham, or Boston. These cities have one of the most creative and productive labor forces in the globe and one of the best paid labor forces in the globe. At the other extreme, you have cities like Detroit, Cleveland, or Flint, with falling wages and shrinking populations. And in the middle, there is the rest of the country that seems undecided.
These are your three Americas, you call them. Yeah.
You have three Americas.
Yeah.
And there's always been more prosperous cities and more vital cities and more struggling cities in America. But what has been changing is that the gap between the one at the top and the one at the bottom has been increasing for the past three decades. I call it the Great Divergence in the book. And at this point, when you look at the map of America, it's almost like you see on one end some very advanced, very creative and innovative post-industrial economies, and on the same map, you see some developing countries with shrinking wages and enormous problems on all sort of aspects of private and social lives.
Now, the example that you used to start out your book in your introduction is a guy named Breedlove who's going to move to Visalia. He's living in Menlo Park, and the idea being Visalia, nice place, more rural maybe, diversity and wages and so forth. Not the case anymore, though.
Not really. Breedlove, the year is 1969, and Breedlove, just like many other professionals at the time, is thinking that urban areas are not a good place to raise a family. He has a house, he has a good job in Silicon Valley, but he wants to something quieter. At the time, Visalia is not all that different from a place like Menlo Park. Sure, wages are slightly higher in Menlo Park and there's slightly more professionals, but at the same time, both cities have a mix of residents, both cities have decent schools, and both cities have a variety of social classes. Now, if you look at the two cities today, 40 years after Breedlove made his choice, almost like looking at two different continents. On one end, Menlo Park has become one of the most vital and prosperous innovation hubs of the world. Menlo Park, including, you know, the communities around it, the entire Silicon Valley area. Visalia hasn't grown in 40 years. It hasn't added any college graduate to its population. Its wages are falling. Schools are very problematic. Crime that used to be higher in Menlo Park is now twice as high in Visalia. Pollution is much worse there. So it's almost like the way I tell these stories, because it exemplifies what has been going on with many American communities. They were very alike in the 60s and the 70s, and they've been growing apart. And now they're almost, as I said, different continents.
This great divergence, as you call it, really goes to the 80s, when the cities began to be defined by education level.
Yes. The key predictor of a community economic success today is the average level of education of its workers, and in particular the number of college graduates in the workforce. It didn't used to be like that. 60, 70 years ago, infrastructure and physical capital were the key predictor of a community success. So workers in Detroit were well paid because they had access to great infrastructure and great physical machines. Today is human capital, the key predictor of a community economic success. And that matters for workers who have a high education, but it matters also for workers who don't have a lot of education. This is the most intriguing part of the story.
Talking with Professor Enrico Moretti, who is professor of economics at UC Berkeley and also the author of a new book called The New Geography of Jobs. And it's not so much maybe the 1% and the 99%. It's more education, innovation, and where you live. At least if you look at a lot of these statistics and a lot of the research done by Professor Moretti. In fact, when you talk about sort of the wages being lifted by at all levels and the standards of standard of living being lifted by these centers of innovation or these cities that are doing well, it gets your research showed that, and correct me if I'm wrong, that every new innovative job in a city creates an additional five non-innovational jobs.
Yes. And this is probably the most important part of the story. Not everyone can work for Google or for Apple or for the latest biotech startup. But the growth of jobs and innovation in a place like the Bay Area matters to all of us, including those of us who don't work in high-tech. And the reason is exactly the one that you pointed out. Every time a community attracts an high-tech job, it indirectly supports many more jobs outside high-tech in the local service sector. And my research shows that this multiplier effect is very large. One high-tech job indirectly supports five additional non-high-tech jobs in local services.
Chris, the idea of indirect job creation can be somewhat murky. I was reading somebody named Peter Capelli, I'm sure you're familiar with, from Wharton, who says, he uses a curious metaphor. He says it's like a big tree, and he says the big tree, you look at all the shade it provides, but then, you know, you could plant new trees also. I'm just curious about your methodology about nailing down these indirect jobs. How do you do?
This comes from a study that was published in an academic peer-reviewed journal, and it's based on looking at where high-tech jobs appear and how many local service jobs appear in the same metro area in the long term. So think about two cities. They're identical in every respect. One receives 1,000 high-tech jobs. The other one doesn't. What I measure is what happens to local service jobs in the city that receives the job. And what I find is that this multiplier effect benefits a variety of occupations, some of which go to workers with a lot of education, the doctors, the teachers, the lawyers, the nurses. But the majority of it goes to workers that don't have a lot of education, the taxi driver, the waiter, the carpenters. And so I think this it's really important for the public debate that we are having in San Francisco and the Bay Area about the future of our city and community. A lot of people look at high-tech and say, well, all those things are nice, but I'll never get a job in a company like that. The reality is that job growth in a place like Apple, Google, or Twitter matters paradoxically even more for people who don't work in high-tech.
Well, that's why Mayor Ed Lee, I suppose, wanted to bring Twitter to San Francisco. I mean, figuring that it would benefit all of San Francisco in the long run, regardless of the tax breaks that he came under a good deal of criticism for that he provided for them. But there's a writer named Richard Florida also, who talks about how you can make a city vital, interesting, fill it with culture, and as a result, you know, things will lift up economically. But yours is, your notion is kind of the reverse of that. If you have a good economy, it will raise the cultural level and do all of that. He uses the example of Berlin, interestingly enough. I mean, because Berlin is a very vital and extraordinary city culturally, but economically it's got serious problems, I mean, especially in comparison to the rest of Germany.
That's right. Richard Florida became very famous 10 years ago with this notion that in order to revitalize a community, the main thing you have to do is to make it cool and sexy and attractive to the what he calls the creative class, and that jobs will follow. There is very little evidence, I mean, rigorous evidence of that. In fact, the U.S., the world is full of communities that are interesting culturally and sexy, but they're not, they haven't really developed much of an economic base. And the example that I have in the book is Berlin. Berlin, in the 20 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall, has become the sexiest city in Europe. It's full of art. It's full of culture. It has both a high brow and low brow. It keeps attracting well-educated Europeans from all over the continent because it's such an interesting, cool place to live. But it economically is one of the poorest cities in Germany. It mainly survives because it's the capital and receives transfer from the rest of Germany. So, you know, it's hard to see how you can revitalize communities like Flint or Detroit using Florida's theories. If it doesn't work for Berlin, it's hard to see how it could work for Flint.
You also have to bring into the equation, if you're going to revitalize cities like Detroit or my hometown, Cleveland, at one point you say in the book, I think quite appropriately and incisively, where are the jobs going in these manufacturing hubs, or what were manufacturing hubs? They're going to China. And you use the example of iPhone, which, aside from the innovation, the engineering side of it, the design side of it, nobody even touches the product until it's a UPS man who is in American hands. And that's the reality.
That's the reality. You know, the reason why I talk about it in a book, because it perfectly exemplifies the way that American manufacturing has evolved over the past 20 years. Design, engineering, marketing are all remain in the U.S., but the physical production of the parts of the iPhone and the iPad, even including the most sophisticated electronic parts, it's all made in Far East Asia. And the assembly, it's in China. Pretty much any other aspect, any other part of manufacturing is going that way. For the past 30 years, U.S. has lost 350,000 blue-collar jobs per year. This occurs not just in recession, but also during good times. At the same time, the number of engineers in the U.S. manufacturing has doubled. So we're moving toward a model where physical production goes away, and we retain the innovation part, and there's a lot of criticism of companies like Apple for outsourcing the production jobs, but they are just one example among a million of other companies that are doing exactly the same.
And what is happening to American manufacturing as a result, or why American communities like Silicon Valley are doing so well economically? Because, as you say, it's innovation. It's not the manufacturing side at all. And innovation is a key on so many levels. I mean, it's had a disproportionate effect on our economy, as you see things. You know, and continues
it does.
To, yeah.
Let me give you an example. Apple has 13,000 employees in Cupertino. They're mostly doing, as I said, engineering and industrial design and marketing. But the real reason why Apple matters for the Cupertino community and the Silicon Valley community is that it indirectly supports about 70,000 additional local service jobs outside iTech.
Doesn't support enough, in my humble opinion, because a lot of the taxes are paid, are not paid at all because of foreign companies. I mean, they don't support, with the kind of tax revenue they could, say, Cupertino College that's right there, or the many of the institutions that are right there, because they're not getting taxed.
Yes, but it does support local service jobs for the people who provide local services to the Apple employees. And as I said, this is the biggest impact that Apple has on the local economy. So remarkably, the biggest impact that Apple has on the local economy is not for engineers, it's for, you know, the taxi drivers, the carpenters, the doctors, and the lawyers, everybody who works in the local service sector. And, you know, 70% of us have a job in that sector. So it's really important. This multiplier effect is really a crucial reason why these communities are doing so well.
You make a distinction between cyclical change and secular change. And secular, I mean, we see things in terms of cyclical change, boom and bust and so forth, but the idea of secular change is really key to your thinking.
It is. Most of the policy debate that we're having really focuses on the short run, how this latest job report affects the presidential election, how, you know, what happens to the recession in, or to unemployment in like in 2 months or 3 months. And of course, those are important questions, but even more important are the secular trends, the long-run trends, because those are the ones that really shapes our life. Those are the ones that change dramatically and can make a huge difference for our communities. So the growing apart of American communities that has been going on for 30 years, of course, it's affected by the recession, but you know, it's a long-run trend that occurs both during booms and during bad times. And I think that's what we should focus much more on, because that's really what our future well-being depends on.
Our guest is Enrico Moretti, professor of economics at UC Berkeley and author of a new book, The New Geography of Jobs. Let me open the phone lines now and invite those of you listening to join this conversation. And indeed, I would put the question to you, how important is geography? How much do you think where you live matters in terms of what's in your pocketbook in economics? It seems to, according to Professor Moretti's research, matter a great deal. In fact, the gap, the widening gap, and it is a widening gap, is in some ways more dramatic than what we've seen in the past about racial differences or class differences, or at least comparable in that way. And certainly you're free to join this conversation, and I'd like to invite you to do that with any questions or comments you might have. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786, so feel free to join the program by phone. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Or you can join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or go to our Facebook page. And, well, here's a comment on our website from Fred, who says, companies that outsource need to be shut down or banned. Free markets and competition are all very well, but what these companies all seem to be seeking is worldwide monopolies. They are just as much a threat to freedom and democracy as the Soviets once were. Another listener writes on the web, I saw the speaker, meaning you, Enrico, at Kepler's bookstore. I didn't get a chance to ask him about the decline of unions. Union members were able to make a living wage without having to have a college degree. Now we see many burdened with college debt, whether they graduated or not, and this is going to have a huge impact on our economy and our society. So many of these discussions ignore the importance of unions in maintaining the middle class.
Well, today, about 7% of private sector workers belong to a union. So unions have de facto becomes irrelevant to the U.S. labor market. I mean, they're clearly important in the public sector, but in the sense that they affect things. But in the private sector, they don't really affect wage setting anymore in any significant way. The decline of unions have paralleled the decline of manufacturing blue-collar jobs. And that's, it has, you know, it's hard to see how it would be reversed. There is, there used to be about 40% private sector workers covered by union contracts in this country. Now it's down to a single digit.
No, it just keeps plummeting, or it has kept plummeting.
Yeah.
But the call, I mean, that web comment also brings up the whole question of education, which is, again, a centerpiece of much of your analysis. Yeah. More educated people gravitate toward and sort of a cluster in different communities, and those communities are better off economically. But we've never seen quite a phenomenon like we have now. They call a college degree a union card, but you've got a lot of college degree baccalaureate students in the liberal arts who can't find work and who are terribly in debt, and they're bringing in no income. And yeah.
Yes. At the same time, I find the current focus by the media on college debt as often misguided. It is true that tuitions have increased dramatically, and it is true that some people are burdened with a lot of college debt. At the same time, college is still one of the best investments that an American young person can make economically. The return to college, meaning the difference between the wage of someone with a college degree and someone with an high school degree, has increased even more than tuition. So one point that I make in the book is that, sure, tuition and cost of going to college has exploded, but going to college still pays off dramatically.
Is this why you come out in favor of federal subsidies for education and all?
One of the reasons why I come up in favor of federal subsidy for education is that the presence of a lot of college graduates in a community has an external benefit, the benefit not just themselves, those who have a college degree, but also those who don't have a college degree. And this is an example of a market failure, which I think it's a policy of subsidizing college degree could internalize.
Let's bring one of our callers on. John, that's you. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. I think there are other factors that are just as important as education in this gulf between the progressive Menlo Parks and the sort of obsolete Visalias. And one has to look to the church, the rise of evangelical churches and creationism and all their emphasis on ignorance, really. One has to look to the concentration of media in a place like Visalia. Most people have been watching Fox and that Murdoch kind of rubbish as opposed to the sophistication of Menlo Park audiences. So you really have to go to these systemic factors in the culture of ignorance, what makes these obsolete parts of America. Thank you.
Okay. Enrico?
I tend to see those factors as more of an effect than a cause for why places like Visalia might be held back. I think it reflects the fact that the population of Visalia only has one college graduate out of 10 residents versus one out of two in a place like Menlo Park. This difference is enormous. It's much larger than the difference in the number of college graduates that you see between the U.S. as a whole and a country like Peru. So these are two communities that are 200 miles apart, but they are much more different in terms of education of the labor force than U.S. and the poor developing countries. And
course,
the gap keeps growing.
The gap that you're talking about, the gap that keeps growing, can be seen throughout the world. I mean, you're talking about places like Visalia seeming almost like part of the developing world as opposed to, say, Menlo Park. But you look at Shanghai in China, and you do in your book, and then you compare China to, say, the more rural outposts of China, and it's the same thing. I mean, Shanghai's thriving, and it's an extraordinarily economically successful city, and you go to the you're in poverty, really, out in the rural areas. We're coming up on a break, but when we return, we'll hear from more of you. Again, feel free to join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or our Facebook page. Our guest is Enrico Moretti. He's professor of economics at UC Berkeley, and his book is The New Geography of Jobs. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour here in studio is Enrico Moretti, who is professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, and also the author of a new book called The New Geography of Jobs. And in the book, he examines why places like the Bay Area, Boston, Austin, and other cities have become brain hubs, attracting creative workers and higher-paying jobs, while other regions, such as those once dominated by traditional manufacturing, are languishing. You can join the program, and we do welcome your involvement. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or feel free to email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our Facebook page. You can also send any questions or comments you have our way by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment. Web comment from a listener who writes, let's not forget New York City's culture, current renaissance in technology jobs. With the emergence of products and services that are reliant more on content than hardware, the city's traditional role as the media sector of the world is being reinvigorated. And look at the decision to build Cornell's new science and technology campus on Roosevelt Island, just a few hundred yards from Manhattan's east side. Comment on that?
Sure. I think it's hard to see how New York City can hold on to the number of financial jobs that it had for the past 20 years. And as financial employment will decline and wages will stop growing in that sector.
And all those big bonuses maybe will start drying up too?
Yep. High-tech will pick up the place that finance used to have. Now, one big problem in your city is real estate. Real estate is extremely expensive, so they don't have a lot of lab space. And in fact, if you look at, for example, number of patents per capita, New York City is not in one of the great innovation centers yet. But it's growing in a number of dimensions, obviously digital entertainment, software, IT in general. And because they have so much of publishing and entertainment, traditional publishing, traditional entertainment already, they're going to have a good run. My prediction is that in 20 years, high-tech or innovation will be the key driver of New York City employment.
Would that be, I'm grateful for you looking into your crystal ball here, but you know, how to maintain U.S. prosperity, how to really secure it and maintain it is the big question underlying a lot of your research and your thoughts on that.
Well, it's clear that there are two engines that are supporting U.S. prosperity right now. It's human capital, meaning people education, and innovation. And it's clear that we're not investing enough in either one. We all know about the problems with underinvesting in education. The U.S. used to be a leader in high school graduation and college graduation, and for the past 30 years has been surpassed by a number of countries.
And also has for many absolutely untenable tuition costs and so forth. Yeah.
Yes.
Was at an event that I did in conjunction with McGill University, and you know, there's up in Quebec they're protesting hikes that look like nothing compared to the kind of inflated numbers that have gone up in terms of tuition costs here in California.
Yeah, the second underinvestment that we're doing is in innovation. People think that America does have some of the greatest innovation hubs of the globe, but at the same time we're grossly underinvesting in R&D, and this is costing us job right now, and it's going to cost us job even more in the future. In the same way that there is a market failure in the creation of human capital, there's a market failure in the creation of innovation. When a company, for example, when Apple invent a new product like the iPad, it generates private profit in the form of its sales, but it also generates an external benefit on all the other companies in the same industry that can see the new product, can learn from it, and will copy the new product. So Apple doesn't get compensated for that part of innovation. So that's why the federal government provides R&D tax credit for innovation, because there is a private benefit in investing in R&D, but it also there is a public social benefit. The problem is that this tax credit are not large enough and they are not permanent. And so I think, going back to your question, we really need to put more resources in investing in human capital and more resources in subsidizing innovation, because they're both are activities that generate vast external benefits for us as a society. It's not a fairness argument. This is just a purely pragmatic self-interest argument.
Understood. We get more of our callers on. Sarah, join us on the program. Hi.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make the comment that, to say that that one job in Silicon Valley creates many jobs, and that those jobs are in the service industry, I think is creating an economy of a few people with much wealth and then many thousands of people serving the wealthy. And I think that your comment about not paying taxes into the community college system is just right. So thanks.
Thank you for those comments. Good to hear from you. We'll hear from another caller. And Laura, that's you. Welcome.
Hi. I actually just relocated from Detroit because I think it was really difficult to remain middle class because the housing prices are continuing to fall. And I think that they'll continue to fall probably for the next 30 years.
Well, you get a mansion in Detroit for...
I'm sorry?
I say you can buy a mansion in Detroit for, well, shall we say, by Bay Area standards, a very low amount of money, yeah.
It's the housing here is shocking. I'm still getting used to it. But, you know, wages are continuing to fall since the 1980s. And what's really happening is that we have these great universities in Michigan, like University of Michigan, and the state and the federal government helped to fund that, but it's a brain drain because everyone at U of M, all the friends that I went to school with, have all left. So you can't even keep those people in Michigan. And also another thing that I've really started to notice is because manufacturing is gone and a lot of those middle-class jobs are gone, people leave the state, and there's a real rise of evangelicals and a lot of a rise in racism. And it actually kind of it began to scare me. Another thing I had to say is that, you know, Detroit had a huge part in helping win World War II. And if we don't have a large working skilled labor force, how can we even defend our country if we were attacked?
Well, you've raised a number of salient points. Let me go to Professor Moretti and get some response.
Well, let me start with your first point. You relocated from Michigan and you came to the Bay Area. Can I ask you, what's your level of education?
Oh, I'm an accountant, and my husband is a software engineer.
Yeah. You know, this is a very important point because there is tremendous differences in the degree of geographical mobility that we see today in the U.S. labor force. Individuals like you with professional jobs and good education tend to be very mobile and are very good at finding job opportunities in cities that have stronger labor markets. Workers that have less education, an high school education or workers who have high school dropout, they're much less mobile. And so, for example, your example it's perfect because it's, you know, the flow out of Detroit of college graduates has been massive, but the high school graduates and high school dropouts are largely still there, and this lack of geographical mobility, coupled with the increasing divergence in the economic fortunes of American communities, is costing less educated workers enormously in terms of foregone job opportunities, higher unemployment rates, and lower average earnings. It's one of the reasons, in my view, that we see such a huge gap between the wages of the well-educated and the wages of the not well-educated. It's this different in mobility rates. Government policies are not helping in this respect. For example, the unemployment insurance system doesn't provide any incentive for people to relocate from struggling communities like Detroit to stronger labor markets. If you are in Detroit and you're living off a UI check, you have no incentive to move to, say, Chicago to get a job because the check wouldn't change, but the cost of living would increase dramatically. So I think it's time that we revisit the incentive system and we help those workers who would like to move, but they can't. They're trapped in declining communities to relocate to stronger labor markets.
Laura, thank you for your call. Appreciate hearing from you, and let's hear from more of our listeners. We'll go to Ann next. Ann, you're on Forum. Hi.
Thank you. I was wondering how the study took account of the enormous cost of housing and commuting differences. So I have a great education, but I have a PhD. I ended up in poverty because I couldn't afford housing here. My brother, who only has a BA, does much better because he lives in a small town in Ohio, and the price of housing is six times lower. how did you look at real wages, which subtracts the actual cost of living from nominal wages?
Yes, you're raising a very important point. The differences when you subtract cost of housing are smaller, although they're still there. In some sense, the vitality of the America's great innovation hubs, the places like San Francisco or Boston or Seattle, has two effects. On one hand, it reshapes the labor market by creating more jobs and raising wages relative to other cities. On the other hand, it reshapes the housing market, as you pointed out. There are two sides of the same coin. Now, the ultimate effect on people's well-being depends on whether they are homeowners or renters. Homeowners benefit twice by being here because they, on one hand, they have a strong labor market, but they also have their main asset, their house, increases in value. For renters, the increase in the strengthening of the labor market, so the higher wages are in part offset by the higher cost of living. Only in part, though, not fully.
I thank you for your call, Anne. And let me go to some web comments. Christopher says, please do not forget this is global, not just restricted to talent flow in the U.S. This morning's news, for example, included a new Brookings report showing again, that Silicon Valley is the number one user of H-1B visas. And Betsy writes on our website, you can go to our website and write whatever you are thinking or feeling, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment. Betsy writes, not true for the life sciences any longer. Once a proud leader of innovative healthcare technology, now the U.S. seems content to have most life science R&D outsourced to overseas hubs such as Singapore, China, and India. I've been in the business of helping small life science companies and startups commercialize their technology for over 30 years, and I've done so in the Bay Area since 1990. Never have I seen so many out-of-work PhD scientists apply for entry-level jobs requiring only a bachelor's degree. Micro pockets of activity still exist, but certainly not enough to create any sustainable level of job growth activity in the life sciences. And Dennis from Las Vegas says, in 1979, I made about $9.50 an hour as a skilled lab technician. United Auto Workers were then making about $22 per hour. I knew it was unsustainable and would come to a bad end, and so it has. Unions got greedy and destroyed the base of our economy. Now they must play the opposite role by helping us to compete with China, etc., on an even footing. Professor Moretti.
Okay, a number of good points. Let me start with the first comment. It was about immigration and the effect that Silicon Valley is still a magnet for highly skilled immigrants. The caller is absolutely right. What's interesting about the great divergence among American communities is that it's not just about American natives. It's strengthened by immigration flows. So cities that have a lot of college graduate among American natives are also magnet for highly educated immigrants. And this further strengthened their human capital base. And cities that don't have a lot of college graduates among American natives are magnets for very low educated immigrants. Today, the American immigrant population is of two types. On one end, immigrants are much more likely than natives to have a college degree or a specialized degree. On the other hand, they're much more likely to be high school dropouts. So it's a very polarized immigration, and the type of immigrants that reach different cities really reflect the type of natives' education. This further strengthens the great divergence among...
Makes
among
the gap greater.
Yes, it does.
Rochelle, join us. Hi, you're on the air, Rochelle. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm from Fresno, California, and I just wanted to say that when I was growing up, I thought that if you made $50,000 to $100,000, you were going to be doing pretty well in life. And when I was in college, I decided to become a nurse, and that's about the wage category that it was projected when I was going to school. And then now that I am a nurse and I'm living in the Bay Area, it just doesn't seem like it's the kind of life that I thought I was going to be living. So I think that where you come from does make a big difference in terms of your perception of wealth. And it kind of, if I would have grown up here, maybe I would have chosen a different major. Maybe I would have gone into law, or maybe I would have gone into business. My second point that I wanted to make is that...
Excuse me, you feel you're just not making enough as a nurse, in other words. Enough of a living like you would imagine would be a prosperous living?
Yes. I didn't think that that I would feel this sensation of struggling to get by and worried about where my child's going to end up in school and things like that. I thought that I would be kind of more more to the middle and high income, and that was just my ignorance from coming from where I did.
Understood. And you,
and then,
yeah, go ahead. You had another point, right?
But my second point is that I'm part of the California Nurses Association, and what we've been recently engaged in is we're part of the attack on unions that has gone on all over the country. I work for Sutter Health, and they've been placing ads in the newspaper saying that I make about 30 to 40% more than what I actually do, to try to turn public perception against us. And so I guess it's kind of a double-edged sword. It's like you feel like you're struggling to get by, and then at the same time, your company is trying to cut your wages. It's just a very nasty feeling.
Erna, Enrico Moretti.
Well, I don't know much about the current labor issues that you're personally facing. What I do know is that, and this extend more. This is more about public sector union. Is that I think they do have a big part, or a great share of responsibility in the backlash, in the sense that for too long public sector unions have tried to defend benefits and especially retirement benefits that are unheard of in the private sector.
Well, look what happened in Wisconsin. I mean, it's emblematic.
Or in San Jose.
Or San Diego. Jose, yeah.
And I think there is, in some sense, there are good reasons for why voters at some points get tired of supporting retirement benefits that are much better than the one they themselves receive from their private sector employers. So in my personal view, and I'm not talking about nurses at this point anymore, but about public sector unions, that part of the backlash is actually caused by the union itself and their not willingness to be flexible.
Let me thank the caller. Belinda says, geography is not accidental. There continues to be evidence of discrimination on the housing market. How can you say geography is more important than race if race affects where you live?
Well, let me just give you two numbers. The difference between an high school graduate salary working in a place like San Jose or San Francisco and an high school graduate salary for a worker in a place like Flint is three times. The difference between an high school graduate, African-American, and a white high school graduate is about 30% on average. So today, inequality and has much more to do with location than with things like class or race.
Again, our guest in studio is Enrico Moretti, who is the author of a new book called The New Geography of Jobs and is professor of economics at UC Berkeley. And our next caller is Drew. Drew, you're on. Welcome.
Hi. Firstly, no offense intended to the professor, but I think that the idea of innovation centers and, you know, where investment is happening, where economic activity is happening, it's quite obvious. And most, I think, particularly here in the Bay Area, are very familiar with the concepts. But the one thing that you're not talking about and most of our political and business leaders aren't talking about is our human agency in making those things happen. For example, what is our political leadership doing to create these centers in some place like Cleveland? Cleveland is a great city. It has great physical infrastructure, great universities, great hospitals, but yet American businessmen choose not to invest there. You don't have Apple going to invest in Cleveland, although the cost of doing business there is low. There's a great trained, you know, intelligent workforce, and there are many, many places like this throughout the United States. And then you look at a country like Germany, which they have been able to keep high-end manufacturing in their country, you know, and that kind of bucks the whole thing the professor talks about. Well, you know, manufacturing is just going to move to China. Well, then where is it going to move? To Vietnam? To, you know, what country? Eventually, you see that the role that human agency takes on in creating these places and what they're doing. And I think that to bring that focus back around on the leadership and American politicians and businessmen's responsibility to invest in America, invest in American cities, not just go, you know, wherever they can make the quickest, fastest return. And I guess this goes back to corporate governance and all kinds of things like that. But, you know, the professor's not talking about that. And that has a huge, huge role in determining where innovation happens.
Enrico Moretti.
Well, actually, a third of the book is about that question. How do we create what type of policy can a city like Cleveland or Detroit adopt to try to attract jobs? And what's clear is that what we're doing now is not working very well. The type of today, the standard industrial policy that the U.S. And local governments are using, it's failing. And the typical policy is to try to attract investment to places like Cleveland and Detroit by offering subsidy to companies that are, you know, they're willing to relocate or to open a new factory or a new lab or a new headquarter. Every time a large company announces plan to open some new facilities, the war among communities starts, the bidding. It's really a bidding war where communities are offering more and more incentives to attract that investment. And the reason why this is not working, it's obvious. Once you have dozens of desperate communities trying to offer more and more to that company, the bidding becomes so generous that this community end up bidding away most of the benefit. And so you have things like Panasonic receiving $100 million 6 months ago from New Jersey to open a lab in Newark. Well, if you do the math, that amounts to $150,000 per job promised. And this is not one of the most outrageous cases. BMW or Mercedes routinely receive in the order of $200,000 per job promise when they decide to open a new facility in the South. You got to wonder whether this is a good deal for the residents of Newark or the residents of Vance, Alabama, that receive a Mercedes plant. And you got to wonder whether this is a savvy use of taxpayer money. The listener is not correct in saying that we're not doing policy. We're spending between $40 to $60 billion annually on this type of subsidy, which is much more than we spend on unemployment insurance in a normal year. It's just that we're spending in the wrong way.
I thank the caller and comment on our web from some on our website from someone who is working now for a high-tech company in the Valley who lived and worked in Detroit. He writes, although I see value of the multiplier effect of innovation to bootstrap the U.S. economy, we would need a couple of orders of magnitude of innovation. Is that feasible in the short term? I would also get the U.S. government to provide significantly more incentives to bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. We cannot survive on innovation alone. I think you'd agree with that, wouldn't you?
I am skeptical of subsidies that target one specific sector over other sectors. I think we should subsidize human capital, and I think we should subsidize R&D investment, because, as we argued before, they generate benefits not just private benefits, but external benefits.
No, you've already said that, but
I don't think we should subsidize manufacturing jobs per se. I think we should let the market decide which sectors are the sectors of the future. And we shouldn't single out one specific industry. Let me point out also that the multiplier effects is not just something for the high-tech sector. It also applies to manufacturing. But it's about a third. The multiplier effect for the manufacturing sector is about a third of the one that you see for high-tech. So if a community attracts a manufacturing plant, it will generate only a third of the jobs in the local service relative to the case where that community attracts an high-tech lab or an high-tech company. And so I'm not sure that subsidizing manufacturing jobs is really the way to go.
Jonathan from Pinole says, to what extent does the prosperity of a geographic hub like San Francisco serve to pull up the economies of poorer surrounding suburban communities like San Pablo or East Palo Alto?
This is a good question. I should have said from the beginning that when I'm talking about San Francisco, I really mean the metro area, which includes the city of San Francisco as well as
surrounding communities. You would agree, though, wouldn't you, that although innovation plays, as you call it, a disproportionate role, it's not only innovation that's creating the kind of cities that we have now and the gap between the cities that you write about. Many factors. It's multifactor.
Absolutely. Innovation will never absorb the majority of American workers. There's no question about it. And at this point, we're talking about 10% of the workforce. And even in a place like the Bay Area, where there's a lot of innovation, the vast majority of people are not employed in innovation. They're employed in the local service sector. And that's why the multiplier effect is so important.
Enrico Moretti is, again, the author of The New Geography of Jobs, professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. And we thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Congratulations on the book. Enjoyed having you. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to remind you that if you have thoughts about what you hear on Forum or what you'd like to hear on Forum, you can always email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website. In fact, you can continue this conversation on our website, going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment, or go to our Facebook page and let us know what you think about what you hear or what you'd like to hear on our Facebook page. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our producers are Judy Campbell and Vinny Tong. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.